begun the review process of prospective candidates on Air Force One flying over. I've been reading about different backgrounds and different opinions and different attitudes of the prospective nominees.
President George W. Bush at a press conference in Europe, talking about, of course, the beginning of a very long process that started earlier on the weekend. That is, we have a resignation on the U.S. Supreme Court, that of Justice O'Connor. We're going to be talking about that resignation, about the career of Justice O'Connor on the court, and about who might replace her on the U.S. Supreme Court as time goes on here, with Lanier Swan, Director of Government Relations for Concerned Women for America, based in Washington, D.C. We're back here in the second hour of Issues, Etc. Our call-in number is 505-7850. Or 1-800-730-2727. Then in about 25 minutes, we'll be talking with Pastor David Runyon Bareford. The United Church of Christ, meeting in Atlanta for their 25th General Synod, made several decisions. The two that are of note concerning, that I found interesting, I think you would find interesting as well. One, they said, Jesus is still Lord. Now, that doesn't mean that every pastor has to sign on to that, by the way. They made it very clear that that's not, you don't have to believe that to be a pastor in the United Church of Christ, and they all but approved gay marriage. So we'll be talking about those two decisions with Pastor David Runyon Bareford, Executive Director of a UCC reform group called Biblical Witness Fellowship, in about 25 minutes on Issues, Etc. In the third hour of the program, we review Dr. Robert Schuller's sermon for the day before the 4th of July. It's called Making America Better, and we'll do it in as our regular sermon review here on Issues, Etc. in the third hour of the program. Lanier Swan, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Thanks so much for having me.
Reflect, if you would, on the career, especially the Supreme Court career, of Justice O'Connor as she resigns.
Well, I think that, you know, she really broke through a glass ceiling for women, and we certainly wish her all the best as she moves on. And we're really looking forward to replacing that swing vote seat with a justice who is firm in their decisions and who doesn't catch us by any surprise.
Now, she was, if I'm not mistaken, a Reagan appointee. What was the surprise?
Well, I mean, I don't really want to speak badly of someone who's made a decision to move on, but I do think that being such a states' rights person, some of her rulings on certain life issues may have come out as a bit of a surprise, considering things she indicated to be her beliefs during her confirmation hearing.
Now, do you think, on the balance, during her decades on the court, she proved to be a pro-life justice?
I think that's hard to say. I think you'd have to ask her. I think she made a lot of decisions based on some outside beliefs and some things that may have changed once she stepped onto the court.
All right, so what is the task ahead for President George W. Bush, those advising him, and ultimately for confirmation, the U.S. Senate?
Well, it can't be emphasized enough that this nominee will be among the most watched in the history of our courts. This is a monumental moment for President Bush. He has the opportunity to appoint someone to the court who is a strict constitutionalist. And that is exactly what we need in a day where Americans have really lost faith in the highest court in the land. And we're really hoping that the president will do what we're expecting him to do, which is to keep his promise from the campaign that he will appoint a justice like that of Scalia or Thomas.
We hear these terms, constitutionalist, you just hear that, use that word, originalist, constructionist. What do these terms denote? What do they mean?
They mean one thing. They mean that the justice sees the Constitution as written black and white law, that justice in no way attempts to create a new law, but instead interprets law based on what our founding fathers have laid out. We are tired of activist judges that are creating new scenarios and new rulings based on their own ideologues. And it's time to move past that and return to the way these courts were founded, to rule based on black and white rule and black and white precedent.
So will this appointment / confirmation process that is ahead, will it ultimately be about abortion and life issues?
It will ultimately be about a multitude of issues. I really don't think you can pinpoint one issue that this is about. This is really about appointing someone who respects our judicial system. That's not to say that today's judges have no respect for it, but This is really about finding someone who rules with a fair hand, who rules in a manner that can be trusted and doesn't catch people off surprise. And that's ruling on all issues, whether it's a socially conservative issue like life, like marriage, like parental notification, or something that is important to those across the board, something like property rights. I mean, look at the Kelo decision just recently where the courts completely shocked America by saying that your government has the right to take away your home if somebody can profit more from the land you live on. I mean, that's something that we take great concern in, and that's not even, you know, a socially conservative topic.
Well, on the issue of abortion and Roe v. Wade in particular, Lanier, the court, as it stood right before the O'Connor resignation, was it a 5-4 in favor of Roe v. Wade?
No, it was not. That is something that has really been miscommunicated, and if you want to call it a lie, you can. The current count, as far as we are concerned, and as far as we've been told, is 6-3. With Justice O'Connor still sitting in as a justice. And so to lose Ms. O'Connor would not be to upset that quote-unquote balance, which is why, you know, this liberal-left perpetuation that all we care about is overturning Roe v. Wade, it isn't true. What we care about is returning to a fair court system. And what may come from a fair court system, that remains to be seen. You can read into it what you want with that. But, you know, as far as the Roe v. Wade count is concerned, it's 6-3.
So who of the remaining eight are pro-life justices on the court?
You know, you have people like Thomas, like Scalia. I won't speak to every single person's vote because I have not asked them personally exactly how they would vote. So it's speculation that it would be 6-3. But it's definitely not a definite split to 5-4. The actual 5-4 vote is the vote on partial birth abortion. And so that, of course, remains, you know, very serious and something that is much in the forefront, because partial birth abortion was something that was signed into law by the president, which means that a decision was made by a democratic process, by our elected officials. And so that's something that the majority of America supported. And when you have a court that works at striking something like that down, they're taking the democratic process out of the Americans' hands. That's a decision that should be left up to the American people, not to life-appointed justices.
Into what category would you put Chief Justice Rehnquist?
Rehnquist is, from what we've been told, a pro-lifer.
So let's talk about the next step in the process. That is the choosing and the nomination and then ultimately the confirmation of the next justice to fill O'Connor's seat. Do you support a litmus test on the issue of abortion for potential justice?
Absolutely not. The litmus test is something that I think came from the other side. You know, if you want to accuse us of having a litmus test, it would most definitely be that of, do you believe in the Constitution? You do? Okay, you've passed. I think that would be the extent of our quote-unquote litmus test. You know, we just want someone who understands the judicial system, who understands that you don't take a piece of law that has been chosen by the majority of the American public and dismantle it just because you personally don't agree with it. This is about ruling on good law, on good faith. You know, there are some liberal justices out there who believe Roe v. Wade is bad law. People who are pro-choice believe Roe v. Wade is bad law, simply based on the fact that it's not constitutionally sound. And so we are really looking forward to a process where a man or woman is nominated who respects the law, period.
So how do you respond to someone who says, okay, we hear you say no litmus test. We heard the president earlier today reiterate again, no litmus test, but we know that these words, constructionists, originalists, constitutionalists, are really just code for people who want Roe v. Wade off the books.
But that's not really true. You know, there are some justices that are, some names that are being circulated as possible nominees, and we don't know with every one of them how they would stand in terms of overturning Roe v. Wade. But I can tell you that we would support most of the names that are being circulated at this time, not because of their identity, but because of who they are and their idea of fair court system and fair law and good law. So, you know, to try to read into our qualifications and just say that all it has to do with this Roe v. Wade just simply isn't true.
So let's talk about the name that has popped up first. that, of course, was floating around even before we knew that there was going to be an kind of unexpected resignation from the court, and that is of Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez.
Right. That is a name that we just do not believe will be put forth as a nominee, not because of who he is as a person. We have had great interaction with him as an attorney general, but because he would have to recuse himself from very significant cases that are up on the docket in the next Supreme Court session. Issues like parental notification, multiple issues that he has offered counsel on either as White House counsel or has had to oversee as attorney general. And based on current law, he could not rule on any of those cases.
But isn't the choice to recuse or not to recuse a completely, I mean, we're talking about autonomous judges, even though they act as a unit when they vote.
Right.
Aren't we talking about, really, it's his discretion as to whether he wants to recuse? What was it at Scalia refused to recuse himself in an issue that had to do with Vice President Cheney when, you know, it was discovered he went out and went goose hunting or duck hunting with Vice President Cheney, and he didn't recuse, and no one could stop him from sitting on that case.
Right. Well, there are some issues, I believe, because of presidential confidentiality, that he would actually have to recuse himself. And on some of those situations, again, like parental notification, the court is split 4-4 on those issues. And the president does not need to have a court on his hands that can't rule. I mean, it simply wouldn't make any sense. So everyone here at CWA, we've had multiple conversations about it. We definitely do not expect him to be nominated.
If he were, would you support him?
We couldn't support him based on the fact that he wouldn't serve as a good justice because he would have to recuse himself so many times.
Who else do you think is the top a front runner for the president's choice and perhaps even for what he's now calling a dignified confirmation process?
Right. Well, you know, it's so humorous to me because they keep calling it a short list, but yet it just keeps growing. and there are so many names being thrown around. People like Senator Cornyn, who has been a terrific senator for the state of Texas and who, quite frankly, I would hate to see leave the United States Senate. But he would be a good choice. Women like Janice Rogers Brown, who we just saw go through a magnificent battle to be finally confirmed, and who on an issue like the Kelo case with property rights, I think folks would really like to see her up there because she is definitely a strong defender of Americans' rights to own property, no matter who could profit more off the land you own. There are lots of other names being circulated to cover the Hispanic question. You know, considering Justice O'Connor was the first woman, this is a seat that could hold a lot of other firsts. And would the president appoint a Hispanic like Gonzalez? And there are names circulating like Mr. Garza's name, who is also a great person. And then, of course, Mr. Boggs. And there are so many names going around that at this point it's almost impossible to keep track of all of them because I feel as though every day that goes by another name is thrown into the mix. And whether it's just a rumor or confirmed that they're actually being considered, there's definitely a lot to look at.
Now, you mentioned Emilio Garza.
Right.
At least according to the U.S. Court's AP and a couple other sources here in our local paper on the little abstract on him, says Roe v. Wade should be overturned, abortion should be regulated by the states. Your comment on that?
Well, I absolutely agree with him based on the fact that, and this is another reason, like I mentioned earlier, that even those who were working in the Supreme Court at the time of the Roe v. Wade decision so many years ago, they agreed, even as pro-choicers, that this was bad law because this is an issue to be left to the states. It's most definitely true. And, you know, there are those of us who consider life to be God's most precious gift. And for that reason, we would hope that, like most states that we've seen at this time, that they would make the decision in a democratic process to ban abortion within their own borders.
Would the president appoint someone who has on the record taken a position or offered an opinion in public on Roe v. Wade? And does a candidate like this have a chance at all to make it through the Senate for confirmation?
It's definitely going to be an interesting couple of days, couple of weeks, few months, as long as it takes to confirm this next nominee. There has been rumor that Senator Schumer was heard on his cell phone today claiming he was ready to go to war over this next nominee. But as far as we are concerned, we're hoping that history repeats itself. And history has shown that no nominee has ever been filibustered, that even if people disagreed with that nominee, they did offer him the respect of a fair up or down vote. And that's what we're hoping for. And in that case, we believe that any nominee we support would be approved by the Senate based on the fact that the Senate majority does agree with CWA and our membership on most significant issues.
Two final questions very quickly. Chief Justice Rehnquist was the one who was expected, at least, he was the one who was expected to say something about a resignation from the court, given his state of health right now that doesn't seem to be improving too much. Do you expect a resignation from Rehnquist before October?
Well, this has been a kind of a running joke between some of my colleagues because I kept saying it was going to be O'Connor and everybody was preparing for Rehnquist and I kept calling O'Connor because I do think that the Chief Justice is really hoping to heal. And, you know, his medical condition is still under speculation. If we were to see him step down, yes, it would probably be in the beginning of October. But there are a lot of people who say that he's improving, and we're looking at a man who has determination unlike most people we've ever seen. So I wouldn't put it past him to try to stick around a little while longer.
And why did you call for O'Connor?
I just had a feeling that in our movement, it is so easy to get caught up in what everybody else assumes is going to happen. And there were a lot of folks who really felt that because she was adding on to her chambers and she was doing different things that she was definitely not leaving. But, you know, she has a husband who is not well, and she has served her time and earned so much respect during her tenure on the court. And I can understand her wanting to end her time now where she can still spend time with her husband and help him to get well.
Finally then, Lanier, when do you expect the president to come up with a name?
Well, as you know, he is overseas, and we have been told numerous times he wouldn't make a decision until after July the 8th, which is his return date. And, you know, it's hard to really fully consider all these names while you're traveling. You've heard so many different interviews with him where he says he is working on it, but I believe that it could be another few weeks after he returns before we see something. I wouldn't be surprised if it took until the first couple of days of August.
How important is this appointment whenever it comes, and do you think it's going to be a bloodbath in Washington when it does come?
Well, I think it is of the absolute importance. We absolutely need a man and woman on the court who is, as I said before, not a swing vote. And because of the nature of this city, how politically divided it has been, we could see a bit of a battle. But I'm really hoping that at the end of the day that both sides of the aisle show this nominee the respect that he or she deserves. They show the process of the nomination the respect it deserves, and they show the president who nominated this individual the respect that he deserves, and that they give this person a fair up or down vote without playing politics with our judicial system.
CWFA.org is the website for Concerned Women for America. CWFA.org. Lanier Swan, thanks for being our guest again.
Thanks so much. God bless you.
Lanier is Director of Government Relations for Concerned Women for America, based in Washington, D.C. Going into this break, and then for a few minutes on the other side of the break, Pastor David Runyon Bareford joins us to talk about the 25th General Synod of the United Church of Christ. Now, this is a rather large and probably, arguably, one of the most liberal mainline denominations in the United States, the United Church of Christ. They met in Atlanta. They made two notable decisions, one that Jesus is still Lord, and two, that they all but approved of gay marriage. We'll find out how far that approval really goes here in these few minutes going into the break and for some on the other side. Pastor David Runyon Bareford is executive director of a UCC reform group called Biblical Witness Fellowship. Pastor Bareford, welcome back.
It's a joy to be with you again.
All right, let's first talk about the gay marriage decision. Did the UCC officially approve of gay marriage?
Yes, it officially approved the definition of marriage as being valid for gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people. And it defined all covenant relationships between all couples as meriting a marriage description both by the church and by the state.
I read in several press accounts that the decision, that the debate and the decision finally made there in Atlanta at the 25th General Synod of the UCC was with little opposition. That is, this thing passed pretty much, one of the press accounts said, with a whimper of debate.
Well, you really do have to understand that there are about that there are 850 or so voting delegates at that Synod. One-third of them sit on national boards or are employees of the denomination, and the rest of them are hand-picked by different conference staff around the country. So the fact that they voted overwhelmingly was not surprising, but it also needs to be noted that this body of voting delegates, especially since the restructuring some 4 years ago, really does not represent the worshiping congregations of the United Church of Christ in any way.
I want to come back to that point in just a minute, David, but what is the official relationship of the General Synod and its decisions to the average UCC congregation?
Well, officially, the Synod only speaks to the local church. The local church has complete autonomy and can, in effect, ignore the decisions of Synod. However, increasingly over the years, these decisions of Synod have come to inform the operating procedure of the local church and ministry committees in different regional areas so that, for instance, pastors that are coming or seminarians that are coming up for ordination or for standing who disagree in any way with the general decisions that have been made by Synod oftentimes find themselves not receiving accreditation because these associations say, well, you really need to be in conformity with the with what the denomination says and teaches. This decision will impact the local church more than any other because churches will have to make decisions as to whether or not they're going to offer blessing ceremonies. So 3 weeks ago, I was in a liberal church in Massachusetts, and that church was struggling with the reality that in Massachusetts, gay marriages are legal, and they had had applications, and so here they were making the actual decision, would they as a church and would their pastor actually perform one of these ceremonies?
So the resolution that was passed in Atlanta, how would you summarize it for us going into this break with just about no more than a minute?
Well, it's a landmark decision, and if those who are listening in your audience are evangelicals, there are some things about the way they went about structuring the decision-making at the Synod that I think evangelicals need to be aware of.
All right, when we come back from this break, we're going to talk about that structuring of that resolution, and I invite our listeners, especially if you're a member of the United Church of Christ, to give us a call, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. You saw the headlines in the paper, UCC Synod backs resolution endorsing same-sex marriage. And then following headline, UCC considers same-sex marriage resolution. Well, the consideration was finally decided. What will this mean in the local congregation then? Outside of states like Massachusetts, where gay marriage is legal, well, in the other 49 states, it isn't, and it isn't recognized. So we'll be talking about that with David Runyon Bareford when we come back. And another significant decision made there in Atlanta had to do, well, it's one of these ma, pa, and apple pie resolutions. At any other general senate or assembly of any other church, it would be. Is Jesus still Lord? Is he Lord and sovereign? Well, when the UCC makes a decision like this, it's not so much apple pie, and we'll talk about it when we come back from this break.
Equipping the priesthood of all believers. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
If you're a talk radio junkie like me, you might assume that the programming is free. Commercial advertisers pay for the production costs and staff salaries. Well, that's true for most talk radio shows, but not for Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is listener-supported. That means we rely on you to pay the production, salaries, and airtime costs for this worldwide outreach. Hi, this is Todd Wilkin asking you to prayerfully consider making a financial gift to Issues, Etc. today. You can donate online, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section. You can donate by credit card, 1-800-737-0172, or you can donate by check, Issues, Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Remember, unlike other talk radio shows, Issues, Etc. needs your financial support. We depend upon you for the continuation and expansion of Issues, Etc.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. The National Association of Counties surveyed some 500 counties in 45 states
about methamphetamine use, and almost 60% reported that meth is now the number one drug problem. A similar survey also indicates that children are often the victims of the unfortunate trend. Bill Wilson has more.
Methamphetamine use across America has hit crisis proportion. This according to National Association of Counties Executive Director Larry Naik.
The methamphetamine epidemic in the United States is having a disastrous effect on our country. The increasingly widespread production, distribution, and use of meth is now affecting urban, suburban, and rural areas throughout the country.
A growing problem, yes, but not an epidemic, says David Murray, special assistant to the White House drug czar.
The notion of epidemic, to the degree to which it signals something out of control and unstoppable, is erroneous.
Even though marijuana is far and away the most abused drug in America, Murray says because of the violent and toxic nature of meth, it is a frontline concern.
For the local and rural police, this is one of the primary things that they confront. They are very right to be concerned about it.
And National Association of Counties President-elect Bill Hansel says children are often the victims of meth.
It's a drug that isn't done in isolation. It's a very social drug. So when you have children present, most likely both parents are doing drugs. Both parents have methamphetamine issues. So you can't place that child with one of the parents.
Hansel is asking both the Congress and the Bush administration to provide a more comprehensive approach to fighting the meth problem. For Family News and Focus, I'm Bill Wilson in Washington.
The impact on the family is also seen in parent users that neglect and abuse their children. The toxins used to make meth permeate children's skin and can cause them severe health problems. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
Dining with sinners. That's what happens every Sunday at Bethany Lutheran Church in Fairview Heights, Illinois. The Lord Jesus himself comes and spreads his banquet table before us, sinners, not a target group of professionals, but sinners in need of the one thing that only he can give, the forgiveness that he won for us at the cross. Christian, seeker, unbeliever, it doesn't matter. All those who are burdened by their sin and hungry for God's forgiveness are invited to visit Bethany Lutheran Church, 5600 Old Collinsville Road in Fairview.
You know, it's possible to read an excerpt of our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for July on our website, issuesetc.org. It's titled, Handling the Word of Truth, Law and Gospel in the Church Today. More information is available from Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. The cost is $12.99 plus shipping and handling. Handling the Word of Truth by Pastor John Pless, our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for July.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. We're continuing our conversation with Pastor David Runyon Bareford. He's executive director of a UCC group, reform group called Biblical Witness Fellowship. The 25th General Synod of the United Church of Christ in Atlanta this weekend decided in favor of gay marriage. And we're talking about what that means for the average congregation individual in the United Church of Christ and another decision that was taken there in Atlanta as well. Pastor Bareford, look, I will regularly and roundly criticize congregations, church bodies, and Christians when they capitulate to the culture. But it appears to me, from my vantage point, that in this case, the UCC is trying to stay out ahead of the culture. I mean, even the culture hasn't made up its mind on gay marriage yet.
Right. Well, I think this is why Christians need to be very aware of this decision. This is the Church of the Puritans and the Pietists. This is the founding Church of the Republic across the Northeast in particular and in several other places as we expanded west. So for it to be making this decision, and for somebody like, for instance, Senator Schumer to at the same time be making the proclamation very boldly that gay marriage needs to be on the front burner of the national agenda, Christians need to be mindful of this and not say, well, I live in a red state and so therefore this will never happen. The other piece that is interesting is that we went to this synod with two resolutions, one that from Texas that asked them to acknowledge Jesus as Lord, and one from us directly that asked them to reaffirm the cross triumphant, this very wonderful symbol in which the crown of Christ's lordship is over the cross of his atonement is over the world. And Interestingly enough, they merged those two into a single resolution that is more strongly worded than any resolution we have ever seen come before the General Synod that reaffirms that the United Church of Christ stands for the Lordship of Jesus Christ, His atonement on the cross for our sins, that we believe in Jesus Christ as Savior and Lord, and it says it in many, many different ways over a very strong three-page document. And it passed. Now, 20 years ago, that would have been unheard of at a synod meeting. You know, we were jokingly called Unitarians considering Christ, and there was no way that the resolution that we saw pass would have ever gotten there. So what we have as two trends within this very liberal church is a sort of renewal of almost charismatic kind of faith and a use of much of the language of an evangelical Christians would be free to use, and at the same time, this affirmation of gay marriage. It is almost as though an attempt to give some kind of profound biblical spiritual legitimacy to this redefinition of what it means to be human in sexual relationships.
Okay, I'm curious about two things. First of all, we'll come back to the gay marriage issue in a minute, but the committee that got the doctrinal requirement of Jesus as Lord, or the resolution, Jesus as Lord resolution you just described there, specifically omitted a doctrinal requirement there in that resolution that would authorize ministers and churches to or say that they must adhere to this most basic of all Christian teachings. It sounds as though they're saying, well, we're going to affirm that Jesus is Lord, but no one, especially our pastors and churches, has to really teach that.
Well, the UCC has always been adamantly opposed to doctrinal requirements. Until, of course, now we have these sort of new implied doctrinal requirements of being open and affirming, and I'm jokingly calling it the new fundamentalism of the left, although I don't think it's much of a joke, in that now that they've moved full circle and come around from the other direction, they would like everybody to conform to their new ideological principles. But that's not the very fact that they took such a strong affirmation and made it would have been history had they not done the other thing at the same time. And the fact that they did both at the same time, I think, is something which Christians really need to take note of, because I believe that it's the new movement. I think it's where it's going, in that it is, in some sense, a promiscuous use of language. But there's no need to feel as though these things need to be reconciled rationally. You can say both at the same time.
How did the General Synod come to the decision they came to on gay marriage? What was the thinking, the thought process?
Well, it goes through a committee process. There were two resolutions considered by the same group of 100 or so. And the consideration was that, one, they considered both this resolution to, they actually considered three resolutions. One was the strongest pro-gay marriage resolution, which they passed. The other was a sort of moderate to study resolution, which they cast off to the side. And the other was that marriage is between one man and one woman, which they defeated. The committee reported them out, one favorably, one no consideration, and one unfavorably, and the synod body pretty well acted in conjunction with what was recommended to them.
Did the practice of blessing same-sex marriage, as it seems to have happened in other mainline liberal denominations, did the practice precede the widespread practice of it in churches precede the official saying, okay, this is something we're going to bless and something that we want to say yes to?
Well, because of the whole UCC being sort of a one-issue denomination and therefore being a magnet both for gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender people and also for people, clergy, who were favorable to blessing those unions, there have probably been more union blessings within the United Church of Christ context than in any of the other denominational situations. But I think this was really a philosophical, this is motivated by an ideology more than just simply practice.
And two final questions, David. The campaign, the media campaign for the United Church of Christ is still ongoing. I think it's called God is Still Speaking, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
And kind of has as its inspiration Gracie Allen saying, never put a never put a period where God has left a comma.
Yeah.
The very thinly veiled message of the media campaign was the welcoming of openly gay and lesbian people. It sounds like the decision taken in Atlanta pretty much follows along with the thrust of that campaign.
Well, again, this is the sort of dichotomous reality. We all believe God is still speaking. And in fact, if you claim boldly and loudly God is still speaking, God is just likely to speak. And therefore, we don't have a difficulty with that. But the comma, of course, implies that there's no clear belief in anything definite that you can depend on. And that, of course, is contrary to what Jesus taught and what we believe as Christians. The bouncer thing, which they're going to do again and again because they're so enamored of the attention that it brought them, is very offensive to other Christian churches. I met last May with a number of bishops from the Anglican Communion and from the Methodist Church who were just outraged and deeply offended by the campaign because it implied that their churches were somehow less welcoming. And in point of fact, the transforming congregations, namely congregations that reach out to people that are in sexual situations that need to be redeemed and transformed and brought back to health by the power of the Lord Jesus Christ, those congregations actually reach out a whole lot more than what happens in the real life on the street situation in the UCC congregation.
Finally, on the big decision taken here on same-sex marriage, do you expect defections of individuals or even whole congregations?
Well, full congregations are going to pull. Last year, we lost, even with the situation just sort of brewing, we lost 160,000 members. Those statistics just came in a week or so ago. So I would expect that this year's loss is at least in the three digits, because local congregations will be forced to develop policy around this issue. And as they are forced to develop policy around this issue, they will be forced to not ignore their relationship with the UCC. And so therefore, I think it's going to precipitate a whole lot more local church action than any other thing they've ever done.
David, thank you very much for being our guest. It's always a pleasure talking to you.
Appreciate being able to talk to you again.
Pastor David Runyon Bareford is executive director of the UCC Reform Group called Biblical Witness Fellowship. Their website address is biblicalwitness.org, biblicalwitness.org. For more information, you can call them at 1-800-494-9172, 1-800-494-9172. You know, a denomination like the United Church of Christ does a lot of relief effort, lots of relief effort. You go to their website, you can find out about the relief they've been sending tsunami victims for the last year or 6 months, and then you can find out about gearing up for relief for the upcoming hurricane season, even taking care of the old hurricane season troubles that are in Florida and elsewhere in the country. But what is it tied to in the UCC? That relief effort becomes an end in itself. It's called the social gospel. They think they're actually, when they say preach the gospel, they think that sending money to tsunami victims or to hurricane victims or to victims of other tragedies is preaching the gospel. But it isn't. It's certainly good to do that, to help people who are in dire need, but let's not call it the mission of the church or preaching of the gospel. LCMS World Relief ties the same kind of relief to the same kinds of situations to the real preaching of the gospel, to the preaching of Christ and Him crucified for sinners, to real congregations where Christ is proclaimed. For more information about LCMS World Relief, look for their logo at our homepage, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org, or for more information, call their headquarters here in St. Louis, 314-996-1683, 314-996-1683. All right, for the remainder of today's program, what do we got? We've got about 60, 70 minutes here to go. A sermon from Dr. Robert Schuller. The last we heard from Robert Schuller was in our interview with him up in Chicago, which we played for you again and again, and giving everyone an opportunity to hear what he had to say. Now, in that interview, Dr. Schuller was very clear that he believed all that stuff about Jesus dying for, he didn't want to use the word sin, he wanted to use the word shame, to save us from shame. But Jesus died to save us from shame. And he was very clear that he believed that. He affirmed that. He grew up with that. I asked him at the very end, how prominent, Dr. Schuller, is the cross in your preaching? to which he gave a very interesting and, I would say, probably evasive answer. Well, let's find out, at least from this Sunday's sermon, The Hour of Power, how prominent the cross, the message of Jesus Christ and Him crucified for sinners, is in Dr. Schuller's preaching. Now, it just so happens the sermon we've chosen here comes from this last Sunday, and that was, of course, proximate to the 4th of July. This sermon by Dr. Robert Schuller is about making America better. Before we listen to the sermon, as we do with all our Issues Etc. sermon reviews, we apply our simple diagnostic tool, our threefold test, to determine whether or not, at a very basic level, you are hearing a Christ-centered, cross-focused message. Are you hearing the preaching of Christ and Him crucified? Or to put it another way, are you hearing the gospel for sinners? Are you hearing a Christian sermon? This applies to any sermon you hear. Dr. Robert Schuller is very famous. He's a very long-lived preacher, but it doesn't only work on sermons of Dr. Schuller's caliber. The sermon you hear on Sunday, the sermon you heard on Sunday in your church, proximate to the 4th of July, it works there well. Number one, how often is Jesus mentioned? Keep a simple running tally. Number two, if Jesus is mentioned, is He the subject of the verbs? This is simple grammar. Is Jesus the one doing the action? Is the preacher talking about what Jesus does for you, has done for you, will do for you, or is He talking about what you do for Jesus? See, if Jesus is mentioned, He's either going to be the subject of the verbs or the object of the verbs. So, in which position, grammatically, does Jesus fall? Is this a sermon about what Jesus does or about what you do? And then, number three, if Jesus is mentioned and He is the subject of the verbs, what are those verbs? What is it the preacher is telling you that Jesus has done for you? And here you call for a distinction between a Jesus who inspires or empowers or motivates, and, as Scripture presents Him, the Jesus who lives and dies and lives again for you. That's the simple diagnostic. We apply it to Dr. Robert Schuller's sermon from Sunday. This is from The Hour of Power. We'll try and get through the whole thing here in the remainder of our program. The sermon here near the 4th of July from Sunday is titled Making America More Beautiful.
If you've been reading our books, listening to our messages, or following our teaching, you know that one of the most fundamental things we teach is you have to believe in yourself, be proud of who you are. And if you don't believe in yourself, and if you're not proud of who you are not going to be the powerful, positive impact, dreaming the big dreams to help other people around you. Now, that's the principle I want to lay before you this morning when I address the subject of how can we make America more beautiful. Because our country, like an individual, we must be proud of who we are. We must not let the criticism of others around us or beyond us belittle us and embarrass us or silence us from honestly and boldly thanking God for the kind of country we are. So how can we make America more beautiful? Well, first of all, by understanding what our positive strengths are and have been, and we strengthen them to the next generation. Yes, we have always been interested in fighting poverty. You wouldn't get that impression from much of the media in the world. We started out in poverty. The people who came here risked their lives from boats across the ocean. This was not a land populated by kings and lords and princes. This was a primitive land with Native Americans. Yes, we started out in poverty. If there was a Horatio Alger Society for nations in the world, America would qualify. We started with nothing. And we've been fighting poverty ever since. Fighting poverty in a way that people will have pride when they receive prosperity and great humility. and real generosity. We've been a country that's tried to move from conflict to coalition. They sound strange, but it's true. When you stop and think of the 13 colonies, how they came from different nations, spoke different languages, did not inherit the same cultures. And here we are, from all of those different lands and ethnic groups, and suddenly, instead of the conflicts that brought our father and mother nations to war, look, there were the French people here, the English people here, and for hundreds of years those two countries had been at each other's throats. There were Spanish people here, and there were Dutch people here, and those nations fought each other and killed each other. Do I need to go on? The people that formed these 13 colonies were from nations that killed each other and hated each other. Now they had to resolve conflict, or at least move from conflict to coalitioning. Do we have a common enemy? Do we have a common goal? We need each other. If we don't realize we need each other, we'll remain in conflict and we won't make it.
All right, so far in the sermon, we're just talking about a minute or so into Dr. Robert Schuller's sermon, Making America More Beautiful. It's pretty clear he's going to be talking about America. But I'm intrigued by the way he begins, and this is completely consistent with what he teaches, as we discovered in our interview with him some time back. Right there in the first paragraph. Right there in the very beginning of his sermon, if you've been reading my books and listening to our teaching, then you know that one of the most fundamental things that we teach is that you have to believe in yourself and be proud of who you are. If you do not believe in yourself and if you're not proud of who you are, you're not dreaming the powerful, positive, big dreams to help other people around you. This is quintessentially Schuller-esque. What's our problem? And he's consistent, folks. You got to hand it to him. What's our problem? We're not proud of who we are, and we don't believe in ourselves. Now, what he's doing is he's taking his message to the individual, and he has, for this 4th of July weekend, expanded it to include all of America. Now, what he usually talks about in terms of you and me, now he will expand upon it and say, okay, but it also applies to us corporately as a nation. We got to be proud of who we are. We got to believe in ourselves. Then we'll be dreaming big dreams. And he's in the kind of historical background section of his sermon so far, where he's talking about it was these very things that made us who we are today. Believing in ourselves and being proud of who we are. But I can also, just to play devil's advocate here, far be it for me to play devil's advocate, but I will. I can think of quite a number of other people outside the United States who were proud of themselves and believed in themselves, and very proud of who they were. Joseph Stalin, he was proud of himself, and he believed in himself. He was proud of who he was. Adolf Hitler believed it. Look at the things these men accomplished, being proud of themselves and believing in themselves. Look at what they accomplished. Big things. And you could name others. You could name many others. Not just the big dictators of past and present, but you could talk about the great philosophers of our age who believed in themselves and were proud of who they were and accomplished great things. Sigmund Freud, he believed in himself and was proud of who he was. At least he said he was, and look at the great things he's accomplished. The influence that he has exercised over virtually every culture in the Western world. So as a recipe for at least accomplishing big things, not necessarily good things, but at least big things, well, at least history would seem to bear out Robert Schuller's formula. Believe in yourself, be proud of who you are, and big things will follow. What those things are is another matter. So, we've moved from poverty to prosperity, from conflict to coalition. The next thing that Dr. Schuller is going to talk about in his Making America More Beautiful Sunday sermon on the Hour of Power is moving from ignorance to education.
We've been a country that's intuitively tried to move from poverty to prosperity, and we have succeeded. From conflict to coalitioning, from ignorance to education. I may be wrong, but I don't think there's ever been a nation in human history where every child, by law, must attend school and learn to read and write. I think America was the first. And we're a country that has tried at its best to move from materialism to spiritualism. You say you're the most materialistic country in the world. I'm not sure of that. If we were truly the most materialistic nation in the world, the government would decide to give everybody the same amount of money. And we've never moved into that kind of a system. Because we know the hardest job in the world is how to give away money without doing more harm than good. And that the real way to achieve material support and strength is to have faith in yourself. It starts in the spirit, not in a dollar bill. So how can we continue to be what we have tried to be at our best?
All right, he's asked a question. He's going to come up with the answer here. And, you know, I wouldn't call him the best modern communicator that there is on television now. I wouldn't call him that. But to a certain generation, Robert Shuler has the kind of communication skills that you need to get your message across. Laying aside the content of his message, he's got it, and he's going to employ one of the oldest tricks in the books, kind of on Mother's Day, M is for the muffins that she made me, and O is for the overtime that she put in at the factory to make sure I had shoes on my feet, and T is for the time she whacked me on the head for being bad, and H is for her loving eyes, and E is for everything else she did for me, and R is for, I can't remember what R was for. Well, he's going to do it with America, A-M-E-R-I-C-A. But the question is, how can we continue to be at our best? How did we start? He says, well, by believing in ourselves and by being proud of who we are. You know, I'll tell you the truth, folks. I have less problem with a message like this from Dr. Robert Shuler. If he just stuck to this stuff, kind of opining about the American spirit, and if it weren't done under the pretense of preaching the good news of Jesus Christ to people, I wouldn't really have a problem if he was running for office or if he were doing anything else like that, just trying to teach us about the spirit of America. Heck, I mean, that's just fine. The problem is it's done under the pretense of preaching God's word. We'll have more of it in our sermon review when we come back.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.